And can you hear me? I'm okay? Does that mean yes or... Yeah, okay. So both spiritual practice and psychotherapy deal with the afflictive emotions and both try to find relief from suffering. That's how they're alike. So I want to talk about guilt tonight. First, from the psychological standpoint, I want to offer a definition, a description of what guilt is, and then talk about the difference between rational and irrational guilt, and then talk about... how to respond to both kinds of guilt from a dharmic perspective. So I have about 3 hours of material here. I'll talk about as much as I can. The definition of guilt that I like the most, people in psychology, nobody agrees on anything particularly, but the definition that I like the most comes from control mastery theory. And the idea... is that guilt, the experience of guilt, has both a cognitive component and an emotional component. The cognitive component, which comes first, is a judgment against myself. It's the idea that something I've done or failed to do has harmed someone else. So guilt comes from the fact that we're social animals, that we're hardwired to feel compassion and empathy for people, at least the people we love. And if we feel we've harmed them, we make a judgment. And then the emotional component, which is in response to that, is a feeling that we are all familiar with, which I think could best be described as depressive anxiety. And it can be really tormenting, right? I mean, the sense of shame where you want to crawl under a rock and you can hardly stand to be in your skin when it's really intense. So when is guilt rational and when is it irrational? It kind of follows from the definition that guilt is a reasonable response when you actually have caused harm to somebody and an irrational response when you aren't the cause or haven't caused harm to someone else. The response to rational guilt, I think, is easier to understand and is fairly straightforward, and I'll just spend a few minutes on that. The preventive for rational guilt is sila, that is a moral code based on compassion and non-harming. If I have a deep commitment not to harm, my intention then is, you know, it will take me away from guilt. One of my favorite Buddhist maxims of all is give no one cause to fear you. It's a really beautiful phrase. I love it. I mean, if I really have a commitment to give no one cause to fear me, I'm not going to harm people deliberately. I'm not going to hurt them. I'm not going to attack them. But I'm also not going to exploit them. I'm not going to shame them. I'm not going to guilt trip them. You know, there's a lot I'm just not going to do. And if I really have a commitment to that, that leads to what the Buddha called the bliss of blamelessness. Beautiful phrase, the bliss of blamelessness. So an ethical life is not merely about being good, because you're supposed to be good. It's really about lightening the load of your own suffering, right? I guess this is off the subject, but has anyone ever been to a metta retreat, like where you spend 7 or 10 days? It's great, right? I mean... what you do on a metta means, for those who aren't in on the lingo, is loving kindness. And in metta, what you do is you send loving kindness, phrases of loving kindness, first to yourself, because the Buddha said you can search all the realms of existence and you'll never find a being more worthy of your own loving kindness than you are. And then you send that same loving kindness out in widening circles, eventually to all beings, so that eventually it's everybody's us. There's no us and them anymore. And people always come home from... It's really amazing to see someone walk home from come back from a metta retreat. They're all just glowing because they've made contact with their own good intentions. It's one of the best cures for all forms of guilt, really, is to an open heart, to really know that at bottom you are, your nature is loving kindness, your deepest nature. But what about irrational guilt? I think that's the more difficult and more interesting issue. That guilt when you feel you've harmed people but you haven't. And irrational guilt is a really, really common human experience. I don't think I've ever... Well, maybe there are some psychopaths who don't have it. I don't know. But it's a very common human experience. I've never really met very many people who don't have it. And it's one of the big issues that people bring to psychotherapy. And it comes from, in my opinion, it originates in a kind of a design flaw in the human psyche, which is called childhood omnipotence. And that refers to the fact that when we're children, children think that whatever, especially young children, they think that whatever happens around them is about them in some ways. They tend to think, and they have a highly exaggerated sense of their own responsibility for the feelings of everyone around them. So, for instance, if mom and dad get a divorce, it's very natural for children to say, well, is it because I was a bad kid? That makes sense to a child. If a parent is depressed, is it because I'm a burden? If a parent gets drunk and violent, is it because I'm bad? You know? And as we grow up, we gradually all start to grow out of childhood omnipotence with a combination of sadness and relief. You know, we start to realize we really aren't the center of the universe and begin to learn that we have little or no influence on most of what goes on around us and much of what other people do. But the problem is every one of us grows out of it imperfectly. And in many families, childhood omnipotence is reinforced. This happens when parents disavow personal responsibility for their feelings and behavior and engage in appropriate blaming of their children, i.e., I'm depressed because you're a disappointing child. My drinking is your fault. I wouldn't have these rages if you were better behaved, and so on. And this is pretty common because... disavowing personal responsibility for your own experience is real common. I mean, insight into the true nature of suffering is relatively rare in this world. And the big delusion that we're all susceptible to, we all do it, is to believe that my suffering is caused by you or something out there, people around me, right? So it's very easy to transfer responsibility, and children learn this. So for instance, you know, when children are abused, for instance, when beaten or just verbally abused, especially if they're very young, survivors of child abuse, when they grow up, what I see a lot is when they're abused as adults, their first response is often not to feel indignant, angry, and to try to and do, take action to protect themselves. The first reaction is guilt. I must have done something to deserve this. Because children have this very touching faith in the justice of the world. Whatever I'm getting, I deserve. You know, I've caused it in some way. It's the omnipotence again. So that's one of the terrible legacies of abuse, is this irrational guilt that when you're abused as an adult, it's very easy just to assume that it's your fault. In dysfunctional families, individual members are expected to sacrifice their legitimate needs for the good of the whole. And the result is that self-care, legitimate self-care, gets conflated with selfishness. So people start feeling guilty for pursuing their own dreams and wishes as if that's selfish and causes harm to others. So many people grow up harboring a deep secret, which is if people really knew me, they would know how really selfish I am because I care about myself. And that's terrible. Right? So this can lead to all kinds of strange manifestations of guilt. If you're financially more successful than your parents and you have this kind of guilt, you can feel guilty that you're showing them up, humiliating them, leaving them in the dust, even if they're long dead. This is a form of survivor guilt. All forms of survivor guilt are irrational guilt, but they're very common. You know, in every disaster, many of the people who survive feel guilty that they survived, as if to take up a survival slot meant depriving somebody else of survival. My survival is at your expense. Again, it's on, you know, a strange kind of guilt. It's very common. And the subtler forms of it, like the financial issue, are also forms of survivor guilt. You can feel the same way if you're more educated than families. You know, and use big words they don't understand and embarrasses them. You can feel terribly guilty about that. Or if you're in recovery from an addiction or from alcoholism, for something that maybe a parent died from, you can actually, I've seen this in a lot of recovering people, they can actually relapse. Because they're ashamed, they're guilty about recovering when a parent or somebody they loved couldn't. It's a way of joining with the parent, of not leaving them behind. To an amazing extent, a lot of our psychopathologies are really pathologies of loyalty. We want to stay connected, and we feel that separating in any of these ways I just described is somehow abandoning or leaving people behind. So this is irrational guilt. Another example, many members of sexual minorities, gay people, transgendered people all over the world, grow up believing that merely by being who they are and trying to live the only life that's in them to live, they disappoint, shame, abandon, are disloyal to their families. Merely by existing, I cause harm. This is the tyranny of irrational omnipotence guilt. Again, I think it's very widespread. I don't know whether any of these examples touched a chord in anybody, but I think it's a really, really common human experience. And what do you do about it? What's the skillful response? I mean, clearly, it is, you know, the skillful response is not to develop more compassion for the people around you who are suffering because you're such a bad person, right? That's not exactly the point. And I'm not speaking against compassion here. But the healing response has to be wisdom. That is, an understanding and deep acceptance of the way things really are. That is, first of all, that this omnipotent ego, child ego, that I may be just grappling with, is essentially delusional, right? It's a fixed view of self. All fixed views of self cause suffering, and this one really does. The idea that I am sort of central to the happiness and well-being of everybody else. It involves a kind of pride. You know, and it's simply false. Also, the wisdom is a deep understanding of the nature of human suffering. The Buddha never said people suffer because other people let them down or don't live up to their expectations. That wasn't the analysis of suffering, right? The analysis of suffering was about your own clinging. Tanha, you know, thirst. You're being in contention with life, demanding that things be different than they are. I want a straight kid and I get a gay one, I will suffer to the degree and as long as I cling to that demand. And it is my responsibility, of course, to do something about that within myself, not the responsibility of the other person to change to suit my needs. This kind of truth is what, you know, the Buddha taught, but it's not very well understood by a lot of people. It's a very uncommon wisdom. So, what I have found to be really helpful in working with irrational guilt is the practice of equanimity. And that's what that handout is about. Equanimity is the fourth of the Brahmaviharas, the four Brahmaviharas. The Brahmaviharas are the qualities of the awakened mind. The first three are loving kindness, compassion, and sympathetic joy. Right, joy in the success and happiness of others. So the first three qualities are all about opening the heart. The fourth quality adds the factor of balance. Equanimity comes from the Pali term, it's upekkha. It means to look over. That is, to have a non-reactive mind that sees the whole picture, that understands things as they are, rather than demands that things be as I would wish them to be. It has to be emphasized that equanimity is not coldness and indifference. Coldness and indifference are considered the near enemy of equanimity. Because indifference or coldness is actually a form of aversion. You know, it's a form of pushing away. I don't want. But if you've developed the first of the three Brahmaviharas, the open-heartedness, you've dealt with a lot of the aversion. And then the equanimity adds a kind of ballast, a kind of balance, so that you have compassion and act from compassion, but also act from wisdom, act from a deep understanding of the way things are. So usually, if you want to Google, since I can't talk too much about this practice, I mean, it's a beautiful practice that I think is kind of neglected. They have equanimity daylongs at Spirit Rock now and then, and they're really very useful to go to. And if you Google it, there's a whole lot of interesting, there's some interesting talks by Gil Fronsdahl and other teachers that you can access. But the practice of equanimity is fairly simple. You know, it's about practicing mindfulness. But then if you're feeling guilty or feeling troubled by a particular problem with somebody, you can then meditate as a concentration practice on some equanimity phrases which are listed. The main traditional phrase is, all beings are heirs of their karma. Their happiness and unhappiness depend upon their own actions more than on my wishes for them. And meditate on that phrase while keeping an open heart. It's not a form, again, of coldness and rejection, but a form of deep acceptance of the way things are. And then the alternate forms of the phrase are a little more modern. Whether I understand it or not, things are unfolding according to a lawful nature. That's really important, that everything arises according to causes and conditions. And the causes and conditions of the suffering of the people around me are vast, right, complex, and, you know, my part in this is fairly, you know, at best is going to be fairly limited. All beings have their own journey. I wish you happiness, but can't make your choices for you. A beautiful, beautiful phrase, I think. A few years ago, I was kind of burned out as a therapist. I was just tired. I went on a retreat and talked to my teacher, and I said to him, you know, I'm just running on empty now. I just don't think I can help anybody anymore. And what he said to me was really astonishing. He said, well, you know, you'd probably be a better therapist if you'd stop trying to help people. And I said, what are you doing? You're talking to all these people all day long? And he said, I'm a truth guy. I tell the truth, you know. And he is what was clearly a very compassionate man. I that's why he has such a huge following. But he said, the truth is, once I've said what I think is true, what they do with it is out of my hands. So it's not indifference again. He cared very deeply. I mean, and he urged me to stop trying to help people. That is, trying to control, push them around, make them see it my way, argue. You know, the struggle that can happen when you're trying to, quote, help people. I found this very useful in my work. It was a startling thing to say, stop trying to help people. And I you understand the sense in which he meant that. It's very wise, actually. So another equanimity practice that's very widely used in the West is something that probably everyone is familiar with in this room. If you're ever in a 12-step meeting, you'll probably hear the Serenity Prayer, which is, you know, a very, it's about a 60-year-old, it's, I don't know how long people have been doing it, but it's a form of equanimity practice. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. So again, it's not in action, you know, it's the courage to change the things I can, the courage to take compassionate action, but the wisdom, that is, and the equanimity, to know what I can and can't change, so that I don't simply react and go off on savior crusades, but I act from wisdom as well as from compassion. And this practice, I think, begins to bring us into alignment more with the way things are. Begins to, you can't do, you know, you don't do this overnight, but I think the omnipotent ego that we all have to some degree begins to shrink a little bit. We begin to see, you know, through that false view of self a little more with equanimity practice. So I really strongly recommend this practice. Anyone, if you haven't been introduced to it, I'll stop in a few minutes. I want to read you a poem from my favorite poet, Mary Oliver, which describes, it's kind of pre-equanimity. It describes, I think, really beautifully what happens when people begin to awaken from the trance of omnipotence guilt and begin to recognize that they have to live their own lives. I kind of like to think that this poem that I'll read expresses something of what the Buddha must have felt on the night when he, you know, sneaked out the back door of the palace and ran away from home, you know. I mean, 29 years old, he'd been prepared to be king his entire life. And this was the night his son was born, no less. And he runs away, you know. And the only word I can use is he had a ruthless loyalty to his own spiritual quest. He had to do this. And you can bet there was a lot of suffering in the palace in the days that followed that action. And how many nights must he have had in the jungle, especially when he was lost for years? He couldn't find the answer to his questions. He must have thought, you know, look what I gave up, and look what I hurt, and look and who I abandoned. I mean, the guilt that he must have felt must have been intense before he found equanimity. But there was a knowing, you know, a sense of loyalty to something in himself, which I think we all have the capacity to have within us. Even people who've been really seriously abused can find that in themselves. So this poem I often share with people who are early recovery from this kind of guilt. It's called The Journey. One day you finally knew what you had to do and began, though the voices around you kept shouting their bad advice, though the whole house began to tremble and you felt the old tug at your ankles. Mend my life, each voice cried. But you didn't stop. You knew what you had to do, though the wind pried with its stiff fingers at the very foundations, though their melancholy was terrible. It was already late enough in a wild night, and the road full of fallen branches and stones. But little by little, as you left their voices behind, The stars began to burn through the sheets of clouds, and there was a new voice, which you slowly recognized as your own, that kept you company as you strode deeper and deeper into the world, determined to do the only thing you could do, determined to save the only life you could save. So I'll stop there and we can have a discussion. Any questions, comments, debates you'd like to have? We have about 10 more minutes. Yes, yes. Omnipotence guilt is born of fear, really, and the child doesn't feel so powerful. I mean, the child feels scared, right? That's one of the things you're saying. Well, yeah, I mean, the fundamental motive behind all of this is to preserve the connection with the parents. Because you need that to survive, for one thing, and also because you love them and want them to be happy. So that's the fundamental motive behind it. And children, especially abused children, have a really hard time facing and accepting how helpless they really are. If I'm helpless, it's hopeless. If I'm being beaten up, say, and it's because dad's an alcoholic, and there's nothing I can do about it, that's a horrible reality to have to accept. But if I can believe that if I just get the rules right, the abuse will stop, then I have hope. And then I have a belief that, you know, I'm in some control of my environment. That's part of what this is about. And that is actually an adaptive response. I mean, it helps people survive. The trouble is when you get to be an adult and people are mistreating you and your reaction is to try to get the rules right so they won't abuse you anymore, now it's maladaptive, right? Now you're in a way perpetuating the suffering by not outgrowing these childhood views of things. But yeah, the terrible contradiction with omnipotence guilt is you feel helpless and out of control, but yet in charge of everything at the same time. To get crude here, in Al-Anon there's a phrase, the piece of shit at the center of the universe, which some people use to describe how they feel when they're... This is how people feel when they're dealing with codependence, which is, of course, another expression of omnipotence guilt. Thank you. Yeah, my best suggestion would be to inherit a lot of money so you don't have to work anymore. But failing that, that's true. I mean, and work is one of the places where this happens the most, where you have to put up with abuse. because you're in a power situation, you need a job, we're in the middle of this horrible recession, you don't just walk out, you know. And so sometimes we're caught in situations where you have to be there, whether you like it or not. And that is the reality. And then, of course, the work then, the only work you can do is internal. And in a sense, bide your time. What helps me the most in situations like that is compassion practice for myself, sending loving kindness into my suffering, and accept my vulnerability to the guilt. You know that, damn it, you know, I'm not. I know he's an idiot. I know he shouldn't be. You know, but it gets to me. You know. Well, stop punishing yourself for that. Yes, I am a vulnerable human being. I am not made of stone. This hurts me, you know. Send compassion into yourself. This is also what a lot of people do who are caught in who are still living at home and dealing with abusive situations too. The biding your time and it gets better. You know about the it gets better campaign. Dan Savage, I think, started for gay kids. You know, just tell him it gets better. Just live in hope that it gets better. And he has all these people do videos of, you know, it gets better for you. It got better for me. I left. I found my freedom, and so on. So there are times when we have to accept painful situations externally. But there is a certain measure of freedom that we can have internally, that we can achieve. It also helps to have supportive friends, you know, and to come home to somebody who loves you, friends who love you, people who love you, know, to be able to do that. But that is true. I mean, it's not all internal. Thank you. All right. Right. Right, right. Yeah. So did you all hear that? The comment was on the category rational and irrational guilt. It's not so distinct, not so, you know, not quite cut and dried as I made it sound, which is exactly right. I was oversimplifying for the sake of getting through a talk in good time. For one thing, we were talking just before you started, you can feel rational guilt, you know, like through ordinary dull-wittedness of daily life, I say something thoughtless to you, and it hurts your feelings. Okay, so, and I feel remorse about it, I feel guilt. So I would call that a misdemeanor, you know, that we all do. But I react as if it's a felony. I beat myself up for days and weeks, and oh, how could, you know. So it's a mixture. They'll mix together a lot. That's one example of when you sort of don't know how guilty should I feel, how much should I punish myself over this. That's where the wisdom comes in. You know, I think the first response. Yeah, let me talk about this for a couple of minutes. This will probably be the last question before we stop. When you have a guilt response, I think the first response ought to be a recognition that you're suffering. You're hurt. Your guilt is a form of suffering, and so the first response ought to be to send loving kindness and compassion into your own heart, into your own suffering heart. And to find some peace in that. Then, when you get a little calm, then it's possible to say, okay, how much of this is my doing, and what's the best way to make amends or atone, whatever I have to do, and how much do I let go of? So I think that the wisdom is essential, because it is not so easy to separate as I probably made it sound in this talk. When the guilt is irrational, I think the thing, when you've decided, you know, I'm really overdoing this, you know, this was not a felony, but you can't stop feeling the guilt. Again, I think that mindfulness and loving kindness practice are very important. The ability to breathe into the guilt, come into the body, and ask myself, where do I feel this in the body? To notice that it's unpleasant sensation, that's all it is. If you've decided ahead of time, too, that the cognitive element, there isn't, you know, no need for the guilt. But you still are, your conditioning is still there. You've still got the momentum of past karma. To breathe into it, to relax into it, and to send compassion into it, even to, like, the meditation I did last time I was here, say, imagining your benefactors, people who love you, sending love into your guilt. So that what you begin to do is to be able to tolerate the experience of guilt without reacting to it. You begin to relate to it rather than from it. That's I think, the fundamental practice with guilt. So that, because guilt, it impels you to action. It's like all anxiety. It wants you to do something now to make it go away. So to not be reactive and to be able to examine it and also to feel it. People who are swamped with irrational guilt, this is a very good practice, because one of the things they have to do is learn to feel the guilt and act anyway. Do the thing that they, you know, like leaving home or whatever it was, you know, that they had to do, to take the action and experience the guilt and work with it, rather than capitulate to the guilt. You know, people say, I can't do that, I feel too guilty. So you can't feel guilt. I mean, you know, guilt is unpleasant sensation which arises, stays for a while, and passes, and comes back, and goes away, you know. But it can be worked with, because it, like all other sensation, is impermanent, right? So, and the more we work with it, you actually are strengthening a muscle. You begin to be able to tolerate it, as well as gradually decrease it over time. Well, we have to stop for now, I think. I want to thank you all for listening, and I think there's some announcements. I have to make one announcement. I write this, you mentioned that I write this column. Some of you get it. If you want to receive it, it's a biweekly column, and I put a sign-up sheet over there next to the Donable. And that's all you'll get, the column. You won't get any political rants or advertisements or anything. Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much, Tom. That was very touching. That's beautiful. I just have a few announcements. First is that we should have this talk uploaded to the Mission Dharma website, missiondharma.org. We've been having some recorder dukkha lately, but this one should have recorded correctly. If we can get some help after I'm done giving announcements, if we could get some help cleaning up, the chairs have to be pushed over to the columns, the cushions go to the back, the tea goes to the back also. And I think that's about everything. But if we can just have a few people help out, it'll go pretty smoothly, and we can all get out of here and get home. Let's see. The Young Adult Dharma Council people, if you can help clean up, and then we'll meet back in the corner again. And I wanted to talk just a little bit about Donna. Tom's been so kind to come here and share his wisdom with us, and he really, whenever I've sat with him, he just speaks from such a beautiful place, from his heart. And for me, Donna is really a practice of receiving something and feeling it in our hearts and feeling how much we appreciate it and how much it's really touched our lives. And from that place, we can offer to whoever's offered a gift to us. In this case, it would be Tom. He's offered so much to us, and we can offer to him as well in the form of financial support from spending time with us this evening. So there's several ways to do that. There is a Mission Dharma PayPal account, which you can get to through the missiondharma.org website. To help pay for the church rental, I forgot about that part, we also have to pay $150 every week to be here. So that you can offer through PayPal, you can write a check to the church, to St. John the Evangelist Church, and you can also put money in the basket, and much of that money will go to Tom this evening. and Howie will be back next week. So thanks so much for coming, everybody. We had such a wonderful turnout. It's been a wonderful evening. So have a beautiful night.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.